for Westaway.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Nice of you all to show up. That's what former Enron chairman and CEO Kenneth Lay had to say to reporters in Houston this morning as he turned himself in and was led away in handcuffs to face fraud charges. Lay says he's done nothing wrong, but an 11-count federal indictment unsealed this morning accuses him of manipulating Enron's books and lying to investors about the energy giant's financial health before it collapsed 3 years ago, costing investors billions. Charles Gasparino is a business reporter for Newsweek. He joins us on the line from New York. Charles, it's taken the government 3 years to get to Ken Lay. Some would say, why so long?
Well, you know, white collar cases of this kind they're notoriously difficult to prove. Listen, when you take on the chairman of Enron, you want to make sure you have a good case. And this case took a while to develop. I mean, I believe Skilling was only indicted a couple of months ago.
Jeffrey Skilling.
So Jeffrey Skilling, the CEO, Ken Lay was the chairman. So it's kind of the domino theory. You go from one, you go from one to the next, and he's the biggest domino.
Well, what are the 11 counts against Ken Lay?
I mean, they range all over the place. Have you read this document? It's a very long document. One of the most interesting things about this is that when it comes to specifics, you only get the counts towards the end of the document, where it talks about Lay's involvement with getting loans and misrepresenting his Enron's financial Enron's financial problems in and trying to obtain loans. And that's what I find really interesting about this. I mean, Ken Lay is going to have a press conference later on today, so it's going to be interesting to see how he basically responds to this. It's just reading this, and I'll tell you, I haven't had a time to read every single bit.
It just has come out.
There seems to be a lot of gray area here, and he may have a very good defense.
Well, for instance, it's known that Ken Lay had online chats with employees urging them to buy Enron stock, saying the company was solid, while he was selling his own stock and must have known that the company was tanking. Is there a charge that you can see that relates to that?
Well, I mean, there's all sorts of stuff involving that. There's a lot of stuff here where it says that Ken Lay should have known or did know that the company was going belly up because he was having conversations with Skilling or various other people, the accountant. The problem is that the company may have faced difficult financial times, but Ken Lay may have been a true believer. And without a real smoking gun, and I'll tell you, I'm reading this looking for a smoking gun, I think it's going to be a difficult case.
Well, some have said that it would be most devastating for Ken Lay if he was involved in the partnerships that were set up by former Enron CFO Andrew Fastow.
Right.
Now, Fastow has admitted to setting up these fake partnerships to disguise company debt and his own ill-gotten gains. Do you see anything there that indicates that Lay was involved with those partnerships?
I don't see him involved with them. I mean, I think what the problem with Ken Lay is that in this indictment, it's saying that he knew about the problems in some of the partnerships. He knew about I just jotted down some notes here. He knew about Raptors. He knew about some of the Wessex partnership. He knew about some of the problems. And what this complaint is saying, essentially, is that Ken Lay misled people about the financial condition of those partnerships. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the interesting thing here is I don't see any smoking guns. Listen, you're the chairman of a company. You would think that you would know that the company is falling apart and that you should make, disclosures. But, going from there to a conviction on financial fraud where you have to show intent is difficult. Mm. And I'm just saying there seems to be a lot of gray area here.
Well, Ken Lay was close to both the Clinton and Bush administrations, but very close to the Bush family. He had his own nickname, Kenny Boy, from President Bush. Yesterday, the Democratic National Committee charged prosecutors with stalling the case against Lay. Have you seen any evidence of that?
No way. Jim Comey, who I believe headed up, at least gave the approval for this investigation, used to be the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District. Now he's Deputy Attorney General, I think, has made a point of, basically cracking down on white-collar crime. Because, the Republicans don't get any points by letting guys like this go. I mean, Ken Lay is a much-hated figure. I don't think George Bush is going to score political points in, post-2001 by going easy on Ken Lay. So I don't see that. And one thing about George Bush, he gives everybody nicknames, from what I understand. I, from what one I remember, he gave reporters on the bus covering him nicknames. Mm. So, in fact,
Ken Lay has said that one of the reasons he is being so doggedly prosecuted, according to Ken Lay, is because he is friendly with George Bush. Briefly, in the time we have, Kenneth Lay used to be worth about $400 million by his own account. He's down under $20 million. We'll hear from an employee. He might not feel too sorry for him in a moment, but just in the few seconds we have, what happens now? When's the trial?
Well, the trial should be coming up in the next couple of months. I mean, this is the indictment, and listen, there's always a chance that there could be some settlement here. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I mean, who knows? I mean, that's always a possibility, and I'm sure they're going to there may be a deal. But, you know, the problem is with settling this thing, I mean, he has to do jail time no matter what, so he may just want to just roll the dice.
Yeah. Charles Gasparino, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Charles Gasparino, business reporter for Newsweek magazine.
Some of the people watching Kenneth Lay in handcuffs today have a vested interest in his fate. They are the thousands of former Enron employees, men and women who lost their entire savings after working years for the company. Charles Prestwood was a plant operations worker for 33 years at Enron. He retired in October 2000, a year before the scandal erupted. We turn to him now at his home in Conroe, Texas. Charles Prestwood, how do you feel about today's indictment of Kenneth Lay?
Well, ma'am, I tell you, I feel good because I feel like that the justice is being done. And it's just like I stated back on November the 19th of 2001, that anybody, I felt like anybody that was involved with the downfall or the destruction of Enron should be brought to justice, face a jury, and find out from there what their fate would be.
Now, you retired from Enron probably expecting a reasonable pension. What's happened to your savings?
Yes, my savings are gone.
At this point, how much did you lose?
$1,310,000 is what I lost in my savings and my ESOP. I retired October the 1st of 2000. When I retired, I wasn't worried about bills or anything, you know what I mean. My financial status was good. A bill come due, all I go write a check and pay it, you know.
Have you received any pensions so far?
Well, I received my pension when I retired, you know, what little it was, you know, $729.
A month?
Per month, and my Social Security of $1,300 per month.
How are you making up the difference between what you were planning on and what you're getting?
Well, ma'am, I'm having to live just as cheap as I can. In other words, I know I'm overweight, but part of that's due to stress and part of that's due to I just can't afford the fat-free foods and stuff, you know. I have to eat whatever I can get. We can buy the cheapest, you know. And it is real terrible. It's a complete different lifestyle of even what I was used to when I were working, you know.
Kenneth Lay has said that his savings have dropped from $400 million to $20 million in the Enron mess.
Well, you know, I know that's what he said, but
you don't feel sorry for him.
I got a different version on that page, you know, that I have.
Did you ever think over the last 3 years that these charges would reach all the way to the top?
Yes, ma'am, I did. And the reason for that is the simple fact is that I have that much trust in our country. I have that much trust in our judicial system. It doesn't matter who you are, you're not above the law, you know. And this right here is proving that to be true, you know.
What would you like to see happen to Kenneth Lay?
Just my personal opinion, I would like to see him go to jail for a long time, you know. But that's all, you know, I can't say anything like that, really, because the jury is the one that determines the fate of him, you know.
Charles Prestwood, thank you for joining us today.
Ma'am, I appreciate it. Pray for me, you know.
Yes, sir.
That's what we need, you know.
Charles Prestwood is a retired Enron employee who lost his entire savings when the company went bankrupt. He spoke to us from home in Conroe, Texas.
The future of Russian oil giant Yukos is uncertain after the company missed last night's deadline to pay $3.4 million in back taxes. And the government today followed through on its threat to freeze some accounts and liquidate assets. Yukos is one of the most important companies in Russia. Its CEO Mikhail Khodorkovsky has been jailed since October and has offered to pay the back taxes with his own stock shares. International investors are nervously watching the Yukos story from the sidelines. Some analysts see it as the comeuppance of a greedy CEO. Others see politics at play. Joining us on the line from Moscow is Fred Weir of the Christian Science Monitor. And Fred, what is the importance of Yukos to the Russian economy?
Well, it's one of the biggest firms in Russia. It accounts for about a quarter of all the oil exports of the country, employs over 100,000 people. It's a tremendously important company, and being driven into bankruptcy as it is could have really serious spread effects throughout the Russian economy and, of course, is going to be extremely negative for Russia's international image.
We mentioned that there's a whiff of politics here. Tell us the backstory. What happened here?
First of all the oligarchs, that is the super rich Russians like Mikhail Khodorkovsky, whom you mentioned, got their wealth in the 1990s by very murky, dubious means during those wild privatizations that we had. Khodorkovsky was more politically ambitious than most, and it seems that was what got him in trouble with the Kremlin, because he's the only one of about a score of them that is being prosecuted and hounded in this way.
Is he seen, though, as guilty as charged?
I think they all are. I don't think there's anybody who lived in Russia in the 1990s who didn't break some laws, especially tax laws. So this is widely seen as a selective prosecution, and although the charges might all be accurate, the question is, why is it only him who's being treated this way?
And what's the answer?
He had political ambitions. He was funding opposition parties. He let it drop that he might like to be president of Russia one day. And in Russia, the Kremlin doesn't sit still for that sort of thing.
What happens if Yukos goes bankrupt or is taken over by the government? What kind of reverberations would there be?
I think the government would really like the ownership of Yukos to be changed. And the company is making it difficult, and Mikhail Khodorkovsky himself hasn't come up with a compromise. I think there are negotiations going on backstage right now on this. But what the government wants is to renationalize the company and put the shares, as a bulk of the shares, in the hands of Kremlin-loyal businessmen. Mm-hmm. And the implications for the Russian economy depend on how bad this battle becomes. If the company is actually bankrupted and dismembered, Russian oil exports, which are the main source of income for the country, could be deeply affected. And in any case, I think Russia's image among international investors and business people has already suffered terribly from this.
And what are your thoughts about what might happen in just the few seconds we have?
I think that it's coming down to a very bitter end game. And the signs today are that the company will, in fact, be driven into bankruptcy and taken apart piece by piece by the prosecutors. You know, the Russians have a saying, we will burn a blanket to kill a flea. And basically, politics are at work here, and that's what the Kremlin will do. It will destroy this company in order to get Khodorkovsky.
Fred Weir, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Fred Weir of the Christian Science Monitor, he spoke to us from Moscow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jennifer Westaway.
It's Here and Now.
Will Nigeria be the next terrorist battleground outside the U.S.? Violence in the West African country, one of the top sources of oil for the United States, is pitting Muslims against Christians. 1,200 Nigerians have died in clashes since January. The unrest is said to be drawing members of terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda, Islamist radicals who are intent on destabilizing Nigeria and disrupting the flow of oil to the West. Ed Blanche wrote about the threat in a recent issue of Jane's Islamic Affairs Analyst. He joins us now from Beirut. Ed, how serious is the violence in Nigeria?
It's fairly violent. Hundreds of people have been killed in recent weeks, and there seems to be no sign of it diminishing. And this is taking place while violence of an ethnic variety is taking place in other parts of Nigeria. But Nigeria has a large Muslim population in the north, and this would seem to be the danger point as far as possible al-Qaeda infiltration is concerned.
Well, is the fighting forcing moderates to more extreme positions? Are the radical Muslim groups drawing more support because of the violence, do you think?
It's difficult to say at this point because essentially the conflict is, as many conflicts are in Africa, about land that happens to fall along sectarian lines. And there have been young radicals in northern Nigeria who tried to launch an uprising last year. This was quickly put down, but the danger is that there have been al-Qaeda emissaries through Nigeria and indeed through most of West Africa stirring up trouble and staking out possible operations for the future.
What evidence do we have that al-Qaeda is actively operating there or targeting Nigeria?
It's not clear whether al-Qaeda is actively operating there in the sense that it's causing all this trouble, but it certainly seems to be trying to exploit it. There have been, as I say, at least two well-known al-Qaeda operatives through that region in the last couple of years, making contacts, establishing positions for themselves. And there's also been a thing called the Al-Multada Al-Islami Trust, which is a Muslim charity funded by wealthy Saudis, which has been accused of funding the uprising last year. And the head of its Nigerian branch, Sheikh Mohandeen Abdulhali, has been expelled because of that. He is also, I think, facing expulsion in Kenya for the same reason. So there is evidence that things are happening there. Al-Qaeda has also been moving south from North Africa in recent months and seemingly to establish a new base of operations in West Africa, in the countries around northern Nigeria that also have large Muslim populations.
Didn't Osama bin Laden specifically target Nigeria in a public statement?
He has mentioned it as one of the areas, one of the countries where he wishes to see a change of government. I believe he called the government in Nigeria, which is the first civilian government in many years, an apostate government, which is a term he's applied to the Saudis and to the Western countries and their Arab allies in the past.
What are they after in Nigeria? Destabilizing the country to do what? Disrupt oil?
Well, it's becoming a major oil production area. The American companies are moving in there very strongly in not only Nigeria but in Equatorial Guinea, Chad, and Mauritanian places. These poor countries that have just discovered oil. So the Americans, I think, are increasingly aware that there is a possible danger emerging there.
Ed, thank you for joining us today.
Okay.
Ed Blanche writes for Jane's Islamic Affairs Analyst. We're joined now by William Tom. He's the former Senior Intelligence Officer for Africa for the Defense Intelligence Agency. He joins us from Woodbridge, Virginia. William, what's the risk that Nigeria will collapse outright?
My gut feeling is that it probably will not be something that will happen very quickly and probably happen very soon. It would probably take some time for these various problems to come to fruition and result in a failed state situation in Nigeria.
Right, right. How big a threat do you think al-Qaeda is in Nigeria in particular, in West Africa in general?
It has potential because what they always seem to be looking and moving into areas where we are perceived as being weak, and that could mean simply not there at all. And, of course, our commitments in various parts of Africa are very scattered and very meager in the security end of it.
How is the U.S., and in particular the Pentagon, responding to that vulnerability in West Africa?
Well, I think that they are slowly taking note of the fact that this is a potential area of serious consequences, largely because of the growing dependence we have on West African oil. This has been discussed various times in the last several years, and it's important. It seems to be sinking in that We now get 15% of our oil from two West African countries, and experts who follow this business indicate it's going to be as high as 25% in the next few years. So it's something that I think we have to take note of.
There was a BBC report in June that speculated that a U.S. aircraft carrier was heading to the waters off Nigeria. What do you make of that?
The point here is if it's true and it happens, it's very significant. Very significant, because in the past, this West African training cruise has been one lonely ship that's gone down there and had played soccer with the locals and did band concerts. I mean, that's basically that was our West African training cruise. Now, if this is true, we're talking about deploying a carrier battle group off there as obviously a show of force that we have not forgotten about West Africa, the importance of its oil, and we are prepared to counter threats there in the context of the global war on terrorism. So it is significant.
William, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
William Tom is the former Senior Intelligence Officer for Africa at the Defense Intelligence Agency.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a new survey says Americans are reading less, and about half have only read one book in a year.
And a new documentary, Some Kind of Monster. It's about the band Metallica and its journey to the therapist couch. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Jennifer Westaway.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Al-Qaeda is planning a major attack in the U.S., perhaps aimed at this summer's national political conventions or the November election. Homeland Defense Secretary Tom Ridge made that announcement this morning in Washington.
Since September 11th, 2001, we've had intelligence that Al-Qaeda intends to launch more attacks against the homeland. Credible reporting now indicates that Al-Qaeda is moving forward with its plans to carry out a large-scale attack in the United States in an effort to disrupt our democratic process. Now, based on the attack in Madrid, as well as recent interdictions in England, in Jordan, and Italy, we know that they have the capability to succeed, and they also hold the mistaken belief that their attacks will have an impact on America's resolve. We lack precise knowledge about time, place, and method of attack.
Homeland Defense Secretary Tom Ridge speaking this morning. Ridge also said that there are currently no plans to raise the color-coded terror alert level. Well, Josh Meyer covers terrorism and security for the Los Angeles Times. Josh, was there anything new in this sort of vague warning from Tom Ridge?
Hi, Robin. Well, I mean, I think vague is sort of a charitable description of it. I didn't hear anything new, and I've talked to several people who are involved in the counterterrorism effort for the U.S. government, and they didn't hear anything new either. And, in fact, some people are wondering why this even happened today. Ridge did say that credible reporting now indicates that Al-Qaeda is, quote, moving forward with its plans to carry out a large-scale attack in the United States, end quote. But that's pretty much the same thing that John Ashcroft said in late May and what other people have been saying for the last several months, including Tom Ridge. So we're sort of scratching our heads as to why this is happening today.
Are you coming up with any answers?
No.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, I think that there is some indication that there might be a little bit more information. But as Ridge himself said in the first question out of the box after the news conference, there is no specificity as to time or place or method of attack. In fact, the FBI says, the senior FBI official said that they don't even know if the intelligence indicates that it's targeting one of the conventions, both the conventions or the election itself. I mean, there's just no specificity to the information.
And also, these kinds of briefings also beg the question, why isn't the threat level being raised?
Well, I mean, and that's another good question. The problem is that whenever they raise the threat level, it costs literally hundreds of millions of dollars for local police departments and Homeland Security agencies. I mean, every day that they do it is a massive deployment of officers, and it's overtime, and people can't go on vacations and so on, and it costs a lot of money. So I think that they're trying not to do that. In fact, Ridge has even said that they might try to do some sort of geographical deployments and so on to sort of narrow the focus of those. But I think that they have to be very careful about raising the level now, especially as we get closer to the election. They might do it later, but they're not going to do it right now, as far as I can tell.
Well, Josh, in the minute we have, are these non-alert alerts becoming controversial in Washington, or is there a sense of sympathy that, you know, we're dealing with such an unknown?
Well, I think at sometimes there is a sense of sympathy. In fact, when you know, Ashcroft released the names of seven people a few weeks ago. Many of those names weren't even new, but there was a little bit more of a sense that there was something out there. But I think today's news conference, it just seems like there's so little new here that people are wondering whether this is just sort of a PR stunt or not. It's hard for these guys to try to do this, because I think they are trying to keep the public aware that there is a continuing threat out there. So you have to sort of give them the benefit of the doubt that they're doing it for the right reasons.
And briefly, in just a couple seconds, do you see this as a softening towards, let's say, the Democratic convention coming up in a couple of weeks when the threat level might be raised?
I don't think so. I think that most people believe that if one of the conventions would be attacked, it would be the Republican convention, because that's where the incumbent president is. There's an interesting debate as to whether al-Qaeda would attack because it wants to get Bush out of office or because it wants to keep him in office. I think the prevailing wisdom is that a large-scale al-Qaeda attack in the United States before the election would actually help Bush, that people would want to keep him in office and keep a steady hand in there.
We'll have to leave it at that. Josh, thank you.
You're welcome.
LA Times reporter Josh Meyer.
Relatives of Americans killed by suicide bombers in Israel are suing a major Arab bank. They say the bank helped the terrorists by paying compensation to the bombers' families. Relatives of the bombing victims say it's as if suicide bombers are getting life insurance. The lawsuit says the money was laundered through the bank's branch in New York City, and lawyers in the case say the payments are coming from Saudi Arabia. Mark Werbner is the lead attorney in this case. He joins us from Dallas, Texas. Mark, who is suing?
It is a group of American families who have been injured or killed during the recent violence in the Palestinian territories.
Okay, families of victims. What's their case against the Arab Bank?
They are showing that the Arab Bank has been a major and knowing participant in financing Hamas and Islamic Jihad and other terrorist organizations.
How does it work?
The money is being raised by the Saudi Committee in Saudi Arabia in riyals, and the Arab Bank was selected to help distribute those monies in the territories to the terrorists and their families.
The Arab Bank says that it's handling money for what it views as a charity that compensates Palestinians affected by terrorism.
There has certainly been money appropriately raised and given to Palestinians who have been suffering and who have legitimate humanitarian welfare needs, but the evidence is going to show that underneath those legitimate purposes, the Arab Bank is knowingly money laundering funds, knowing that that money is being directed to terrorists and their families to further the violence against civilians in Israel.
What about the arguments that this lawsuit is American families who lost loved ones want compensation because Palestinian families who lost loved ones got compensation?
These families have been devastated by acts of terrorism, and many of whom have lifetimes of medical needs. But it's also brought by all of these American families because they're determined to fight back against terrorism. And by this civil lawsuit, they have the ability to play a part in the war on terrorism, and they hope to shut down terror financing by this lawsuit.
Well, if it is terrorism financing, why is this a civil lawsuit instead of charges laid by the Justice Department?
There is a role for governments to play in the fight on terrorism, for armies to play, but there's also a role for private citizens. And the U.S. Congress passed the Anti-Terrorist Act that wanted to give one of the tools to private citizens. There may be actions taken in the future by criminal authorities where they deem it appropriate.
This is a lawsuit that involves the Arab Bank, but is there, you mentioned that this was a committee, a charity based in Saudi Arabia. Is there Saudi government influence in this as well?
The evidence shows that Arab Bank, one of the largest international banks in the Middle East with over $25 billion of assets, one of the major shareholders is the government of Saudi Arabia, and certainly the Saudi committee, which is headed by some high-ranking Saudi officials, have been complicit in sending money that they knew was being directed to terrorist families.
How much money are the families suing for?
The suit seeks over $875 million, and as additional Americans who have been injured join the suit, I certainly expect that that number will increase and eventually will exceed $1 billion.
Mark, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Mark Werbner is the lead attorney in the case. He joined us from Dallas, Texas.
Still to come, backstage at the Kabuki Theater.
You're listening to Here and Now.
The Philadelphia public school system has made an astonishing discovery. 1,200 works of art, including over 100 by American masters like Thomas Aikens and Henry Tanner, hidden away in boiler rooms, bike closets, and basements of schools across the city. Natalie Paquin is the chief of staff for the city's public school system. Natalie, tell us, how did you find these works?
Well, in keeping with our emphasis on good business practices, the School District of Philadelphia, we began a process of inventorying all of our assets, which included our arts. So what we did over a year's time is we visited every building, we visited every classroom, every office, every closet, every boiler room, every basement. We looked under stages, just searching our facilities for art.
What was the art doing there in the first place? I mean, these are paintings by Thomas Aikens and Henry Tanner, museum pieces.
Yes, well, not every piece is a museum quality piece, so I have to emphasize that.
Mm-hmm.
And what the pieces were doing there, we believe that at some point in the past, engineers or custodians of the schools probably put the pieces away for safekeeping. And when you're doing construction on a building or you're painting or renovating a building, you would put a piece that you cherish in a safe place. And as administrations change over, sometimes people just did not know that we had significant art stored away.
Wait, 264 schools were inventoried. We understand that at least 100 of the pieces are fine art. What are you going to do with them?
We are putting together an arts advisory council, and that council will advise us on what we should do with the art. Hopefully, the art will be restored and shown for the citizens of Philadelphia. We believe that this is a treasure and a collection that belongs to the city and to its citizens and to our students.
We understand that the art expert who helped you do the inventory said that it could easily be worth $20 to $30 million. And some would say, you know, that the schools could use that money. Why not sell the paintings to benefit the schools?
The collection is worth more than its monetary value. It really is rich in terms of its history, in terms of what an artist was trying to say, and we believe that there are great educational tools that can be created from this collection.
Won't it cost the schools, though, so much to restore many of the paintings that need restoration after sitting, you know, in a boiler room, and then to keep them safe? If you put them up, it would seem like you'd have to have, you know, an expensive museum-quality building to do that.
We are seeking the help of many art advisors and people who enjoy art and know more about art in the Philadelphia community. We also are inviting other stakeholders, principals and teachers and community leaders to participate in an art advisory council. One of the areas that they will be charged with is helping us find gracious donors to help us restore the art.
Mm. Natalie, have you seen them? I mean, I can't imagine pulling an Aikens out from behind, you know, a furnace somewhere. Have you seen them?
Yes, I have seen.
What are they
all
like?
The pieces. They are beautiful. They are beautiful pieces of work. We have portraits. We have early 19th century pieces. We have impressions. We have WPA works. And so there is a little something for everyone here.
Natalie Paquin with the Philadelphia Public School System. Natalie, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jennifer Westaway.
It's Here and Now.
Stagehands are building old Japan on a Boston stage. For the first time in 15 years, Kabuki Theater is coming to America. The tour begins at Boston's Cutler Majestic Theater and moves to New York City and Washington, D.C. Kabuki is more than 400 years old. Actors wearing white face paint, elaborate wigs, and richly embroidered costumes enact the traditional stories of Japan, and all to the live music of instruments such as the shamisen, or Japanese lute. Here and Now producer Emiko Tamagawa recently caught up with Peter Grilly, president of the Japan Society of Boston. The society is sponsoring the Heisei Nakamura-za Kabuki Troupe's Boston stop. And according to Grilly, although Kabuki has become high culture, its origins were lowbrow.
It originated early in the 17th century as a kind of very popular kind of street theater, wandering actor, musician, dancers, who would wander through the cities of Japan and put on sort of impromptu performances in the streets or in big open places.
So how long have you been a Kabuki fan?
Since I was about 15. And so that's a good 5 decades or so. Not to give away my age completely, but a long time.
How would you describe Kabuki to the uninitiated?
It's a very varied and very energetic form of theater that combines acting, dance, music, and a really fine kabuki actor has to be both an actor and a singer and a dancer of really high accomplishment. So one way of describing it is combining Nureyev and Laurence Olivier in one performance with a little bit of Enrico Caruso thrown in, maybe.
And it is all male?
It's all male and has been all male since about the middle of the 17th century.
And it also has a rigorous training. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, the training is very rigorous and starts very early in a performer's career. Child actors begin training when they're 3 years old, 4 years old. It's traditional to make your debut on the kabuki stage at the age of 6, especially if you're born into a kabuki family, and the art of kabuki is really handed down from father to son to grandson.
So there are kabuki families that go back generations and generations, right?
Many, many, many generations. In fact, the star of the troupe that's coming to Boston, Nakamura Kankuro, Kankuro is his name, his family goes back 400 years, and he is next year going to inherit his father's name. His father was one of the great kabuki actors of the 20th century, Nakamura Kanzaburo. And next year, Kankuro will take on the name of Kanzaburo. And it's somewhat like a royal family where names change. When you're the crown prince, you're called one thing, and then you become king or emperor, and you become Henry VII or something like that. Kabuki has very much the same sort of practice.
What can the audience expect from the performances they'll see either in Boston or New York or Washington?
We've picked plays that don't emphasize language and text so much. They rely much more on the beauty of the dance and the movement. So people needn't be hung up on what they're not understanding or the words that they're not understanding, because the text of these plays is really quite simple. There's very little dialogue. They'll be doing two plays. on the programs in Boston. One is called Bo Shibari, or Tied to a Pole. And it's a very simple story. A lord is going off for the day, and he doesn't want his servants to get into his liquor cabinet, his sake cabinet. So he develops this ruse. He'll tie his servants. He ties one of them with his arms straight out, tied to a pole, and the other one he ties the hands behind the servant's back. And he figures there's no way they're going to be able to break into the sake that way. But they do. They break into the sake, they get totally drunk, and when he comes back, he finds them rolling around on the floors drunk, but still tied up. In the other piece, which is called A Dance for Two Lions, or Renjishi, Kankuro will perform the elder lion, and his son, whose name is Shichinosuke, will perform a young lion. And I think many people in the listening audience will sort of have a mental image of kabuki from the lion dance. It's probably the most popular, the most recognizable form of kabuki dance. In this play, the two actors first come out as court dancers rehearsing a piece for two lions, and they become obsessed with the spirit of the lions. They go off stage, they come back in these incredibly resplendent costumes, long, long manes, very stylized lion costumes, and perform a wild dance of a father lion teaching a younger lion how to hunt and how to behave.
The emperor could not hear my words. His army will come. It is the end. For 900 years, my ancestors have protected our people. Now, I have failed them.
So you will take your own life. Shame. Shame for life. Service. Discipline. Compassion.
The way of the samurai is not necessary anymore.
The son, in this case, Shichinosuke, has recently gotten a measure of international fame. He played in the movie, The Last Samurai, the Tom Cruise movie about Japan that was very popular this past year. He played the Meiji Emperor, the young boy emperor in the film. And his father, who's a much bigger star in Japan, is always joking now that in America people are going to be much more interested in the son than they are in the father.
Become a very technological society. There's so much that's sort of developed, and kabuki has become sort of this art form, museum quality. Do you ever worry that it might become obsolete?
There was worry, fears about it becoming obsolete 20 or 30 years ago. When I remember when I first started going to kabuki, the audience was almost totally old women, and many of them were asleep in the audience. But because of the efforts of younger actors like Kankuro, like Tamasaburo, Takao, other great actors of the present day, who feel determined to bring kabuki back to its popular roots, many younger people are coming back into the theater now. The audience at the Kabukizai in Tokyo, the main kabuki theater, is full of all ages now, and it's a much greater sense of vitality than there was 20 or 30 years ago.
After all of these years, Peter Grillo, I have to ask you, what keeps you going to kabuki?
I keep going because there's an enormous repertory of different plays. I love the stories of the plays. I learn a lot about Japanese history from the plays. But also, I've probably seen the lion dance in kabuki done by 12 or 15 different performers, and I'll go back and watch 15 more, because every time it's different. Each performer brings his own special stamp to the part.
Peter Grilly, president of the Japan Society of Boston, speaking to Here and Now producer Emiko Tamagawa. The Heisei Nakamura-za Kabuki Troupe is appearing at the Cutler Majestic Theater in Boston tonight through Saturday. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Jennifer Westaway.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.